As a kid, I loved The Twilight Zone, and there's been almost nothing as mind-bending on TV since, until now, with Black Mirror.
This video came from YouTube.
Well, get it off there!
We did, after 9 minutes, but that was long enough for it to be downloaded, duplicated, and spread.
Each episode is a near-future speculation on how digital technology might just bite us back. I'll talk with the show's creator, Charlie Brooker.
There's a lack of control going on in this day and age. It's not quite clear who is in command.
So what now? What's the playbook?
This is virgin territory, Prime Minister. There's no playbook.
And we'll hear about the late Alan Lomax. He brought American folk and blues to the mainstream, but now some scholars are wondering about the stereotypes he brought along with them.
A gypsy woman told my mother before I was born.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and lots more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But first, when I hear about a new band or musician, the first thing I do now is go to YouTube. YouTube has really become kind of a default music player, and plays on YouTube now count in Billboard rankings. So, Google, which owns YouTube, wants to capitalize on this. It's launching a new service called Music Key. Users will subscribe to it like they do Spotify and Pandora, and Music Key will share a little bit of the revenue with artists. Fine. But as always, the devil is in the details, and there are a lot of them. Zoe Keating has been blogging about the agreement Google wants artists to sign in order to have their music on Music Key. Artists like her. Keating is a successful cellist and composer who writes a lot of film and TV scores and has had best-selling classical records on iTunes and Billboard charts, but she's now best known for talking about artists' rights in the digital new world. And she joins me now, Zoe Keating. Welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So over a year ago, YouTube approached you about signing a new agreement, which you don't like. What's your problem with it?
There were a couple things that jumped out at me. One of them was this catalog commitment, which was that in order to participate, I had to agree to include all of my catalog in the new Music Key service, and that anytime there's anything new, that it would be in there.
And why is that so important for you and for artists like you?
I just believe that I have the right to control when I release my music at what time. And so the contract required me to, anytime I have new music, it required me to release it on YouTube at the same time that I release it anywhere else. I kind of was like, wait, how can you tell me to do that? I've always released my music to my core fans first on Bandcamp. I mean, the bulk of my income comes from my core fans who pay what they want on Bandcamp. I think that really is a model that works for sort of a niche artist like me.
Uh-huh.
So I asked my rep at YouTube if I could just cross out those two terms. I said, you know, I'll sign this. And they said no. And then she told me what the consequences would be if I did not sign the agreement.
And those consequences are to be what? That you're not on YouTube, period?
Well, this is the contentious part of this. It was very clear, and they stand behind this one, that I can no longer monetize content ID.
And content ID, just to be clear, because nobody knows what that means, it's
yeah,
a kind
right.
of middleman service that allows you to take little bits of the revenue that
that
YouTube
content,
collects?
Content ID was created to solve a problem that YouTube created, which was that people are uploading, you know, quote, illegal content up to YouTube. So in addition to what I have on YouTube, which is not very much because I've never made an actual music video, there are about 10,000 user-generated videos. We call them as third-party videos, and those are videos of people's dance performances or art projects or little films, and there are 10,000 videos up there that YouTube has found. So that's like the whole contract business was that in order to keep Content ID going, I have to sign a new version of that agreement.
So basically they're saying they're cutting you out of any chance of making the relatively small sums of money that you've been able to make or could make if you chose to from YouTube videos.
Yeah. It really rubs me the wrong way that they're linking up my participation in Content ID with my mandatory participation in Music Key.
So what they're saying basically is we are Google and YouTube. We control all these things. Therefore, we're saying you have to play by our rules. If you want to be on any part of us, you have to do what we say to be on all parts of us.
Yeah, that's the message.
Now that you've become this poster girl for complaining about it, why have you done that? Gone public and blogged about it and so forth?
Well, I mean, I've always blogged about what's happening to me, I think, because for some reason I seem to occupy a position in the music industry that is not often heard from. And that's like an artist who is not struggling and an artist who's not a megastar.
Right.
Sort of the artistic middle class.
Right.
But with this particular issue, after I had spoken to the rep, I was just really amazed at that it was YouTube, after all these years that I've been doing this, about 10 years I've been doing it, that the first time that I was hitting a roadblock was a technology company. When it was the internet and companies like YouTube that allowed artists like me to actually even have a career.
Right.
And then suddenly that they were dictating these terms that I thought were the kind of terms that I would get from a record label, which is why I never went down the path of having a record label.
Uh-huh.
But also, I felt like the terms were onerous, and I felt like Google was hiding behind an NDA, and that if there was a little bit of public sunshine on these terms, I didn't think that they would hold up.
An NDA meaning a non-disclosure agreement, which means you can't talk about any of this, supposedly.
It's not that you can't talk about the terms of the contract. You can't even talk that there is a contract.
Yeah.
So I just decided to take a risk, and I thought that it wasn't right what was happening, and that I thought that if I blogged about it, I had a hunch that maybe some people might agree with me.
Is your line in the sand clear? Have you decided what you're going to do? Are you going to sign the contract or not if they don't make it what you want it to be?
If the contract was going to stay the way it was, I was not going to sign it. If they're going to change it, then I'll see where we're at. So I would like my listeners and all those people with those dance performances and all that stuff, I'd like them to be able to keep doing that. But I'm not going to do it at the expense of that control over releasing my music whenever
right.
I want to.
Right. Good luck.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for talking to me. Have a great day.
Thanks. Zoe Keating's latest project is scoring the new A&E TV show The Returned, which starts in March. Every year, we ask you to send us your New Year's resolutions, the ones for creative projects that you need a bit of encouragement or threat of public humiliation to get off the ground. We pick four of you to follow all year long. This year, we heard from many, many of you, including Joseph Riedel from Croton-on-Hudson, New York, and he is here with me now on the line. Hello, Joseph.
Hi, Kurt. How are you doing today?
Good. So tell me about your New Year's resolution.
Well, it came out of a pretty bad situation, actually. Back in the end of September, early October, I was diagnosed with a localized form of cancer called a chordoma. Basically, I have a tumor growing in my skull in between the sinus cavity and the brainstem. And I just recently moved back to New York from Chicago, where I'd been studying and working in the television field. And the plan was to start up my career here, but then this sort of got in the way. And after a long bit of sort of feeling bad for myself for not being able to start things up the way I planned, I decided to turn it around and start writing about my current health situation. And turned out people were interested in hearing about it. So I just started pursuing the idea of writing a web series.
Well, it's a horrible thing to have happen when you're young. How old are you?
I'm 25.
So your plan is to use this illness as the basis for a web series. What do you envision? How many episodes? How long will they be?
Well, I want to start telling them in 10 to 15 minute chunks. And the original idea was to do a 10 episode season. But because I want to be very true to life and sort of journal what I'm going through, there's always room for growth because, you know, what if tomorrow something incredibly interesting happens and I need to write a whole new story arc about that in addition to what already is out there.
But this is not going to be a documentary, even though your real life and your real experience in the course of treatment are going to be embraced. But you see this not as a drama, but as a comedy, more or less, yeah?
Right. I mean, the thing is, of course, there's going to be dramatic stuff because just by nature, this is a traumatic experience. But I want to show people to kind of look at this the way I've started looking at it fresh, which is I was so angry. But there's more than just the anger, and really a good sense of humor will help you get through whatever hardships life throws at you.
And you're calling the title of the series is what?
A Good Sense of Tumor.
There you go. And the treatment that you're undergoing entails what?
Well, right now, I actually got some good news this week. It looks like we might be able to cure this with just the surgery, which is a huge weight off my shoulders because radiation has been on the table as a possibility and all these other things. So I go under the knife, and I'll be in the hospital for a bit after that, and then sort of confined to bed rest and minimal activity for the next 2 months after that.
So your goal for this first series is to have it finished before the end of the year? What's your timeline?
So I want to get the majority of it written and, you know, committed to go to production while I'm in recovery. So by the time I'm up and about back on my feet, we can just jump in and start producing and cranking out content so that I'm posting things starting September, finishing up filming in October, and then post will go through the end of the year.
Well, you sound incredibly well organized in your plan. You're hiring or you're gathering actors. So will actors play your siblings and your parents and your friends, or will some people play themselves? How will it work?
Yeah, that's something I'm still deciding. I have a little sister who's 16, who's a brilliant actress. The question is, does she want to play herself? Because I love her to death, but I don't always paint her in the best light in the series.
Oh, well, this is just fantastic. I'm really pleased you're doing it, and I'm really pleased and flattered that you're allowing us to watch you do it all year long.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so thrilled that you guys showed interest in it. It really sort of, like I said, this has been a very dark time for me, and knowing that there is an audience for the kind of work I want to turn this into shows not only that people care about my health, but also care about me as a creative.
Well, good luck, Joseph, and we will be checking back in with you.
Sounds great. Talk to you later then.
You can read the script for the pilot episode of Joseph's web series at studio360.org. And I want to thank everybody who sent in their resolutions. And I encourage all of you to keep in touch with us on our new Facebook group for Creative New Year's Resolutions. It's a place to share your creative goals and accomplishments and works in progress and join a community of resolution makers. Just search on Facebook for Studio 360's Creative New Year's Resolutioners and join us. Coming up, the TV show Black Mirror is really good at previewing plausible everyday nightmare futures. And in fact, its creator, Charlie Brooker, endures his own little nightmare every day.
Every writer I know has an inner critic who's constantly sitting there going, "This is rubbish. What you just typed is rubbish, and the next thing you type is going to be more rubbish. See, told you."
My conversation with Charlie Brooker is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. A couple of months ago, I started hearing about something called Black Mirror. It was like a secret password whispered between my friends. Black Mirror. Have you seen it? You've got to see it. When I finally did and binge-watched it, it was more astonishing than I'd even hoped. Black Mirror is a British TV series that straddles sci-fi and super-realistic horror. Each standalone episode looks at how technology is warping our lives and extrapolates that to fascinating extremes. Charlie Brooker, who's the show's creator, had made a name for himself as a critic and humorist and TV writer in the UK, but he was always fascinated by The Twilight Zone, which he'd watched in reruns as a kid.
I was always a fan of that kind of twist in the tale, spooky, creepy, what-if, speculative fiction. I read up a lot about Rod Serling and his life and what had interested him. McCarthyism, psychology, you know, the space race, the, you know, Cold War. And so I thought, well, what's the current version of that? What concerns me now? And I think pretty much while I was thinking this, I was probably reading something off a device and, you know, which was reflecting my own sorry face back at me. And so the way that technology has marched in and upended everything over the last really relatively few years seemed like a good sort of starting point for what a bunch of what-if stories,
right?
Basically.
The show is about technology, and there are some cool devices in it, but it's mm-hmm. really about, as you say, the way they transform the rules of life and society.
Yeah.
In the first episode, mm-hmm. Which I want to play a bit from, apparently a terrorist of some kind, kidnaps a princess and in a ransom video says she'll be killed unless the prime minister goes on live national TV that afternoon and has sex with a pig.
Mm.
Of course, the video ends up on YouTube and the clock ticks down. And this clip from that episode is where the prime minister is talking at home with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you worrying.
You never patronized me. Don't start now.
Whoever this is insane.
And has a princess.
Who'll get through this?
Not just any princess. The princess. Princess bloody Facebook bloody eco-conscious national sweetheart.
I won't have to do anything.
Everyone's laughing at us.
You don't know that.
I know people. We love humiliation. We can't not laugh.
Nothing is going to happen.
It's already happening in their heads. In their heads, that's what you're doing. What my husband is doing.
That is the national anthem, the very first episode of Black Mirror. The premise is right at the edge of plausibility, and at first yeah. seems like a shocking, funny sketch comedy premise, but then you play it very seriously and realistically and not as farce, and it becomes kind of heart-wrenching. That was the intent?
That was definitely the intention. I mean, it was, and, you know, it actually came about as a comic idea I'd had when I was writing a newspaper column. Huh. And when I started initially sitting down writing the script, the model I had in mind was 24, the series 24, and I was sort of writing almost a parody of 24. And then as it went on, it became apparent that actually what's interesting here is to take this joke premise and actually make the man at the center of it and his wife real people
yeah.
who are going to be utterly humiliated and devastated by events. And there's a lack of control going on in this day and age. It's not quite clear who is in command.
Because of YouTube and social media and all the rest.
You know, within the show, you've got the traditional media are powerless to stop this.
Right.
You know, the government is powerless to stop this message going viral. The media are powerless to sort of, they're playing catch up. The public don't even really want what they're then given, basically, yeah. at the yeah. end. You know, it's harrowing and it's repellent.
In several of the episodes, and maybe all of the episodes, intimacy and relationships and husbands and wives are central and how technology mm-hmm. is reshaping them. There's one episode in which people can record everything they see and then review it later, which isn't very good for marriage, it turns out.
Mm.
Is the technology our villain here or is it us villainizing ourselves?
I don't think technology is the villain. I mean, this isn't, despite maybe appearances, I don't think it's an anti-tech show, really, because I'm quite, you know,
yeah.
I'm quite
No, you're
geeky.
Clearly ambivalent. Yeah.
It's more that, I mean, in that particular episode, it's more that guy is clearly sort of jealous and possessive and troubled anyway, you know, and he is just enabled by the technology, I guess. The technology enables him to indulge his weaker side, really, within right. that story. So I don't think, within the stories, it's partly because it's more interesting to me to, because they're human stories, and so if you keep them fairly intimate and about kind of, you know, everyday lives and human interests, like romance and, you know, or sort
infidelity,
of career pressures or
comes up infidelity, again and again.
All of that kind of, it yeah. does come up quite a bit, actually, that, doesn't it? Yeah.
yeah.
But that is more immediately accessible than a bunch of,
sure.
you know, aliens in robes discussing trade agreements in Vector 5,
yes.
you know, so
yes.
so in a way, that's it's kind of weak people using powerful
right.
tools
right.
is quite often what we depict.
And the technology, that this futuristic technology is really well imagined, but also...
Oh, I love it, yeah.
...really beautifully mocked up using, of course, cool technologies.
I mean, and sometimes we really fetishize it ourselves. I mean, just on the show. Like, so in there's an episode called Be Right Back where... with Hayley Atwell and Donald Gleason, and Hayley plays a woman whose boyfriend dies and is replaced by a sort of AI equivalent that's drawn from his tweets and Facebook updates and what have you. But within that episode, she's an illustrator and she's depicted using this
yep.
Kind of piece of drawing apparatus that really our FX guys, who are very, very, you know, we've got this FX team who are brilliant. And they were putting together, I think, their dream device. And I think when sort of illustrators and graphic designers watch that episode, they all go,
I want it.
Where did she get that?
yeah.
I mean, this is always the watchword with the show. We've always had I get very involved in all the conversations about the design of stuff because I find that knocks me out of the moment. If I'm watching a movie and someone receives an email
yeah.
and the email is depicted on their screen as a giant spinning envelope because that's more visually interesting,
yeah.
I'm immediately thinking that's yeah. not real.
Yeah. Yeah.
So hopefully... We aim for the tech as depicted within Black Mirror is hopefully usable, but it's seductive.
Yep.
It should look like you want it. It should look like it helps you and you would want that in your life.
Black Mirror is broadly political, I guess, in its critiques of the world, and a couple are explicitly about politics. But you've said that beyond being, quote, broadly leftish, you don't get worked up about problems and political controversies very much. And I empathize with that. Does that mean we're part of the problem?
I mean, maybe. I mean, maybe. There are many who would say yes. I mean, I sort of think it's really, I think that comes about because I don't think I have the moral certainty that a lot of people seem to express when they get involved in a political argument. A lot of people are seem, from my perspective, to be extremely secure in their position and all their views and what they think. And then when it becomes a sort of my team versus your team kind of mindset, I find it hard to relate to.
Right.
Because I think I am more racked by self-doubt, which is possibly a weakness within me. But I think that's why I find it hard to necessarily 100% subscribe to to one concrete point of view all the time. I don't know. It feels like we're in an age where everything is getting a little more polarized, and all debates that happen are a little more. We're still figuring out how to use social media and stuff like that. It's kind of like the whole of social media strikes me as being like a conversation in a pub at closing time when everyone's a bit rowdy and things could kick off at any time. If you say the wrong thing, you know, that like it could devolve into screaming at any moment. And I think we will just kind of get used to dealing with that as a species, because at the moment it's kind of like a new vehicle we're learning to drive and we're smacking it into the walls left and right.
Your most recent episode, the seventh, which most Americans have not yet been able to see, is called White Christmas, and it stars John Hamm as a guy who, among other things, helps single guys navigate dating by watching them through their eyes and talking into their ears. Here's a clip from that episode.
Amy, hi.
Get her to introduce you to the dark hair girl.
So, are all of your friends this suspicious?
Nice.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
This is Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Now focus on Amy, and we'll do that funny material that we worked on.
Anyway, this guy gets off the horse, and he's got a backpack, right?
The tactic, generally, was to deliberately freeze out the one you were actually interested in. For one thing, you wouldn't seem needy, but also they would most times sort of lean in naturally. People want to be noticed. They don't like to be shut out. It makes them feel invisible. But this girl seemed content with being ignored.
Maybe she could smell a loser.
No. No. She was an outsider. An attractive outsider. And there's nothing more tantalizing than that.
Within that episode, we do ride through lots of conceits that we've sort of slightly introduced in previous episodes, and there's little Easter eggs for fans of the earlier eps. We've sort of got little there's a reference to every single episode buried away
really?
In there somewhere. Oh yeah, you just have to look very closely. But it's funny because I immediately saw people speculating over whether this means that Black Mirror takes part in one shared universe. Well, of course it does, because we're all in one shared universe.
Yes.
So, yes.
I am told that the American channel AMC has asked you to make an American version of Black Mirror. Is that so?
We've had conversations with people about continuing the show, or sort of doing a what do you call a reincarnation? Or so there's all sorts of ongoing conversations, which I probably can't elaborate on.
Right. Well, it worked for House of Cards, so that you could do it too.
It did work for House of Cards, didn't it? Yeah, there you go. I think if we were, you know, if we were to do that, we would want it to feel more like a continuation than a rebirth,
right,
so to speak.
Right,
but there's
been
it's quite interesting having John in our Christmas special immediately makes it feel more transatlantic anyway.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, there's no reason why we can't go in that direction. We're an anthology. We can kind of reinvent ourselves week to week.
Yeah.
So I guess sort of wait and see.
You are a critic and a funny, sometimes vicious critic. As you're making things, as you're writing and producing this show, do you have to turn off or pay attention to that inner critic?
I don't think you ever can. I mean, I think that every writer I know has an inner critic who's constantly sitting there going, this is rubbish. What you just typed is rubbish, and the next thing you type is going to be more rubbish. Yeah. See, told you, rubbish. and really, the only way I've ever found to deal with it is to have a deadline set for you and have things get to such a crisis that the voice that's screaming, this is going to be late, you've got to type it, is drowning out the voice that's saying, uh-huh, this is rubbish.
Uh-huh.
That's literally the best tactic I've ever come up
wise
with.
Wise words, is to basically wise words, yes.
Get to a crisis point. And I think that's often why things I write tend to seem quite feverish, paranoid or angry, is because those are the conditions. The rest of the time I'm just eating peanuts, you know, and walking around the house sort of playing video games. I play a lot of video games in my downtime. I'll sort of say, right, if you write two more scenes and then you can play Far Cry. You know, it's sort of that. That's my work ethic. It's pathetic, really, isn't it?
It works for you, and it has been a pleasure speaking with you, Charlie.
A pleasure to speak to you, too.
The first six episodes of Black Mirror are streaming on Netflix right now. The seventh, starring Jon Hamm, is for now available only on DirecTV. I talked with Charlie Brooker for more than half an hour, and for those of you who are real Black Mirror geeks like me, you might enjoy listening to that whole conversation at our website, studio360.org. One of the most influential people in American music, Alan Lomax, would have turned 100 years old last week. Lomax wasn't a musician or a songwriter or even an impresario. He was a song collector. His field recordings helped launch the folk and blues revivals of the 1960s, and he influenced everybody in music pretty much. It's possible that without Alan Lomax, we wouldn't have had rock and roll as we know it. But among scholars of music these days, Lomax's reputation has gotten a lot more complicated. There's been a backlash against some of his assumptions about American culture. Richard Paul explains.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine.
Let's start by giving Alan Lomax his due. The collection of recordings he assembled is nothing short of monumental. He started when he was 17, working with his father, John Lomax. Toward the end of his life, he imagined using computers to put the collection online before most of us knew what online was. Many of the years in between, he spent on the back roads of America.
This past summer, I spent traveling through the South with my father, collecting the secular songs of the Negroes.
This is a reading of an article Lomax wrote as a teenager.
Work songs, barrel house ditties, bad man ballads, corn songs.
This was 1932, when doing that was a radical act.
There certainly were not a lot of people who were interested in African-American culture.
Patricia Turner is a folklorist at UCLA. In the era of Amos and Andy, she says, Alan Lomax was someone
who thought that the everyday artistic expression of African-Americans ought to be recorded and ought to be preserved.
It started in the South. Started from slavery.
Yeah.
And as
he recorded musicians playing, but also talking about their lives, like this recording of Big Bill Brunsey, Sonny Boy Williamson, and Memphis Slim.
The same time, that's the way they paid. They didn't know anything about rent and those things in those days.
But you agree with me that blues helps a man out?
Yeah, for the feeling. You make it.
Lord, I can hear my name a-ringing all up and down the line. Oh, Lord, I can hear my name ringing all up and down the line.
Lomax considered song collecting to be something like a sacred mission. Here's how he described his quest in an interview near the end of his life.
I wasn't interested particularly in the old lazy ballads. I wanted the real raw stuff right out of the backwoods and off the creeks, and so the stronger it was, the better.
And he imagined himself in battle with a demonic enemy, the radio.
Not very long ago, there were hundreds of little separate communication worlds that existed everywhere, literally hundreds of thousands of these little generators of the original. And suddenly, all those delicate structures are being smashed and scattered and suppressed by an overpowerful, over-rich, overreaching communication system.
Ain't got long, I ain't got long. Lord, I ain't got long like the mother's home. Pray for me, oh, mama.
On his first trip, he wrote about it for the Southwest Review. Alan Lomax set out with his father for a labor camp. They asked the white foreman there if he'd have his men sing them their work songs. Worker after worker turns them down, saying they only sing church songs. So the Lomaxes ask around and find the night spots where the guys go on weekends. But they're scared to go alone, so they bring some muscle.
On a Friday night, with a brace of city detectives to serve as our card of admittance and a guarantee that we were all right, we went into the dives and joints. Our hopes ran high. Until we noticed that shortly after our entrance into a beer parlor, a constrained silence would fall on the assembled men and women. We four, with the bartender...
Awkward. Here's the real problem. Lomax's blind spot. He was in search of pure black music, not realizing that, for the most part, it wasn't there. Carl Hagstrom Miller is author of a book called Segregating Sound, Inventing Folk and Pop Music in the Age of Jim Crow.
There's a difference between what folklorists were searching for and what people were listening to and enjoying.
That's because despite the brutal laws of segregation, black and white cultures had been mixing, going back into centuries of slavery.
White slave owners and black slaves lived together, worked together, and worked the plantation together.
Remember that scene from 12 Years a Slave? It was blacks who learned and then played the waltzes, jigs, and reels at white people's parties. During the Great Awakening in the 1830s, blacks and whites went together to Camp Revival meetings. There, African religious and musical practices were dissolved into Christian hymns to create the songs we now call spirituals. Then, in the 1880s and 90s, vaudeville and Tin Pan Alley created a nationwide music industry. Dwandalyn Reese is the curator of music at the Smithsonian's new African American History and Culture Museum that's opening next year.
By nature of the close proximity that two different cultures have by living next to each other, it's inevitable that the music and the cultural products that they're producing are intertwined and interrelated. People were singing each other's music, so to speak.
Ain't you coming along? Come on here, come on here, Alexander's ragtime band.
But when Lomax would show up in a black community,
he didn't ask, share the songs that you enjoy singing. He asked for them to find songs that fit into his idea of old-time folk songs.
If a man gave him a Tin Pan Alley number, or a church song his granddad learned at Fisk, Lomax would wave and just drive away. He never recorded at black colleges. It would take 14 years before he ever recorded in a black church.
You have no opportunity to hear what middle-class African-Americans are into or what upper-class African-Americans are into or urban African-Americans.
So where did he find his raw, real, authentic black music? In penitentiaries. Parchman Farm, Central State Farm, Angola.
The black communities were just too difficult to work in with any efficiency. And so my father had this great idea that probably all of the sinful people were in jail. And that's where he found them. That's where he found this incredible body of music.
Yonder come a Miss Rosie, how in the world do you know? Well, I know about an apron,
as he wrote back in the 30s, in prison, if his sources weren't cooperative, they could be coerced easily.
Presently, the guard came out, pushing a Negro man in stripes along at the point of his gun. The poor fellow, evidently afraid he was going to be punished, was trembling and sweating in an extremity of fear. The guard shoved him up before our microphone.
He got a lot of unique music this way, like this song from John Gibson.
Yep, like easy now. Bring him off in the short quarters and walk over close by with him.
Lomax wasn't ashamed of his methods. On the contrary, he saved for posterity a song that no one had ever recorded and possibly no white person had ever heard before.
The most important thing that anybody can do is to try to restore the balance. I call this cultural equity.
That's a very complicated issue.
Again, Duane Reese from the Smithsonian.
It gets back to this issue of black music and white music and the expectations of who should be singing what. Also, the expectations and perceptions of what is African American, who is African American. And that gets embedded into stereotypes, degrading stereotypes. African Americans are criminals. They're illiterate. They're not serious. They're not smart. And so that authenticity is rooted in having that kind of vision of what an African American can or cannot be.
There is also a completely different way to look at this.
I don't think about authenticity at all when I'm playing music, man.
That's Dom Flemons, a longtime member of the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
I wished I had a nickel, I wished I had a dime, I wish I had me a pretty girl, you know I'd call her mine.
They got really popular in the early 2000s, playing songs that leaned heavily on the Lomax music collection. Now, Dom is the same age as all these scholars, and like a number of them, he's African-American. He knows everything they know.
I'm not trying to, like, give Alan Lomax a pass or anything.
But still, he lands in a totally different place, because for Dom, the music is the thing that really matters. And without Alan Lomax, it would be gone.
A guy just sitting on a porch at home playing and enjoying the music is just him enjoying his music by himself. But if you want to hear it on a record, someone has to record that.
Was his music authentic? Is it the truest representation of what African Americans sang and listened to in the 1930s? His answer? Who cares?
In any of my musical work that I've put out there, I've tried to take what I've learned by experience as well as take the scholarship that's been done about any of the stuff that I play, and I just try to find the best balance between that so that there's dignity. You know, from on my end, I tried to make sure that when we said it was traditional music, it sounded like traditional music, at least how, you know, the best I can do with the documentation that's there.
So there are at least a couple of ways to look at this story, but this much is undeniable. Right at the time the Civil Rights Movement was trying to bring blacks and whites together in a common cause, Lomax drew a hard line between white and black music, one the record companies were happy to exploit, that kept us apart. As critical as Dwendolyn Reese is of Lomax, she does have some sympathy. She knows that we all have to make decisions and that, whether we know it or not, we all have biases.
I can't jump in his mind. I think he was trying to, in his way, collect what he thought was a true African-American cultural form of expression. And we all do as researchers. We all have our own biases and perceptions and expectations. And that's part of the challenge of doing that kind of work.
It's fair to say that in this story of black and white,
everything's always usually a grayer area than the history books write it down, you know?
For Studio 360, I'm Richard Paul.
So what do you think? I'm betting some of you have pretty strong feelings about that story, and we'd like to hear them. Visit us at studio360.org and leave us a comment. While you're there, you can see Alan Lomax discuss his life and work in a 1991 interview with Charles Kuralt. Still ahead in Studio 360, my interview with the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Tracy K. Smith.
I gave myself permission to let anything even mildly important to me as a person into my work.
I'm going to let David Bowie in. I'm going to let Frank Zappa. I'm going to let them into the work and see what happens.
That's coming up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Confession, I don't read a lot of poetry, but I do love discovering any kind of writer whose work is both beautiful and accessible, such as the poet Tracy K. Smith. She won the Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago for her third book of poetry, Life on Mars, which is partly inspired by her love of David Bowie.
Some Americans torture brown. Now Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow.
It's also about her relationship with her father, an engineer who worked on the Hubble Space Telescope. Her latest book is not poetry at all. It's a memoir called Ordinary Light, and a lot of it's about her relationship with her mother, a deeply religious homemaker. I spoke with Smith about her family in 2012, just after she'd won the Pulitzer Prize. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
In my introduction, I described your work, which I like very much, as accessible. I realize that in some circles, that's probably offensive or a fighting word. How do you feel about it?
I don't feel offended by it. I actually feel happy about it. Like, I'm interested in using language and having fun with what it can do and what it can create, but using it as a tool to get toward understanding and insight. And if I'm thinking about something that is mysterious or difficult or complex, I like when the language can be as transparent as possible, just to make way for the larger thing.
And your project includes the world as we know it and live in it, and there's nothing wrong with referring again and again to David Bowie, for instance.
I gave myself permission many years ago to let anything that is interesting, even mildly important to me as a person, into my work. And around that time, I started realizing, oh, you know, I'm going to let David Bowie in. I'm going to let Frank Zappa. I'm going to let world events that that I had felt were not quote-unquote poetic in the past, let them into the work and see what happens.
Speaking of David Bowie, I'd love it if you'd read the first section of the poem, Don't You Wonder Sometimes.
Sure. Don't you wonder sometimes? After dark, stars glisten like ice, and the distance they span hides something elemental. Not God, exactly. More like some thin-hipped, glittering Bowie being, a star man or cosmic ace, hovering, swaying, aching to make us see. And what would we do, you and I, if we could know for sure that someone was there squinting through the dust, saying nothing is lost, that everything lives on, waiting only to be wanted back badly enough?
That was Tracy K. Smith reading from her poem, Don't You Wonder Sometimes, about David Bowie. Was Bowie an obsession of yours when you were a teenager?
I remember, watching some 1980s music videos like Let's Dance. It's not even, I guess, what we now agree as David Bowie's best moment. But as a kid, and then as I got older, I became really interested in the Ziggy Stardust era. I wasn't even a kid, I have to say. I was probably like 30 when I became kind of obsessed with that moment. And I think what was so powerful about it to me was the sense of the imagination as something that is capable of creating a whole new world and a whole new sense of self. And I really have always just been so grateful to that. And I wanted at some point to find a way of writing toward that in my work, acknowledging that.
A big section of this book deals with your father's death a few years ago. You write, "Who were we without your clean profile nicking away at anything that made us afraid?" What was your dad like?
My father was, when I was growing up as a child, I thought of him as larger than life. I thought of him as this Renaissance man who could do anything.
He was a scientist.
He was an engineer.
Yeah.
And he was deeply interested in the world and how things worked and grew and transformed. And he loved making furniture, and he, you know, grew trees from seeds because he was curious about what would happen.
It's like a dad in a movie or something.
Yeah. I have very sweet memories of him. And when I got older, he became human in a way that was really wonderful. We became friends in a way.
Would you read one of the poems about him, the one called It's Not?
Sure. It's not that death was thinking of you or me or our family or the woman our father would abandon when he died. Death was thinking what it owed him, his ride beyond the body, its garments, beyond the taxes that swarm each year, the car and its fuel injection, the fruit trees heavy in his garden. Death led him past the aisles of tools, the freezers lined with meat, the television saying over and over, "Seek and ye shall find." So why do we insist he has vanished, that death ran off with our everything worth having? Why not that he was swimming only through this life, his slow, graceful crawl, shoulders rippling, legs slicing away at the waves, gliding further into what life itself denies? He has only gone so far as we can tell, though when I try, I see the white cloud of his hair in the distance, like an eternity.
That's Tracy K. Smith reading It's Not, from her new book, Life on Mars. He worked on the Hubble telescope.
Yes.
Which has obviously been sort of one of the big deal in observational astronomy the last several decades. How did that, having a father who did that, sort of shape your view of existence?
To be really honest with you, when he was working on the Hubble, I was 8 years old. I became really interested in looking at these images after he passed away.
Uh-huh.
And somehow
the images that the Hubble has captured.
Oh, yeah. And then I could remember I remember the first book that he received with some of those images in them and him showing them to me and telling me this is what I was able to help, you know, contribute to. And maybe it's taken that many years for that to really register for me.
And he's an engineer. You're a poet. Are those such different ways of thinking about the world? Did they lead to differences between you as father and daughter?
Well, I remember my father, although I never read one of the poems that he supposedly wrote when he was young, my mother would always tell me that when they were courting one another, my father would send her love poems that he had written. And I always felt like, okay, there's this kernel of connectedness that he and I share, even though we veered in these very different directions.
How did you start reading, caring about, and then writing poetry?
I guess there are all of these different starting points. The earliest one I can remember is grade school, writing a poem, and feeling wise. But when I was in college, I was lucky enough to be exposed to a lot of living poets. I was at Harvard in the early 90s, and Seamus Heaney taught there, and Lucy Brock Broido and Henri Cole were other really important teachers that I had. And, you know, I would see that poets were people who ordered meals and, you know, wore shoes and
burped.
Did all the things.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. And it seemed like something that I could imagine doing right then instead of waiting until I was at the end of my life.
Although it also, one can imagine, okay, thinking, on the other hand, I'm an undergraduate. This is an undergraduate folly, fancy. But you didn't have that. You said, no, I can actually do this.
When I look back, it feels a little pretentious. I remember I chose to declare that I was a poet. And I remember my roommates at the time being so annoyed because I would say, I can't go out. I need to work on my poems. I need to stay home. But for me, I think what was happening was I was discovering a language for articulating some of those feelings that are normally inarticulable for somebody who's in, you know, late adolescent.
Tracy, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Tracy K. Smith's new memoir, Ordinary Light, comes out this spring. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. I hope you enjoyed the show. For me, I gotta say it was a little bittersweet because we said goodbye to a friend. For the last couple of years, John Delore, the Reverend John Delore, recorded, sound designed, and mixed Studio 360 every week. He is a consummate professional, a creative mastermind, a really good guy, and everything he laid a finger on here, he made better. John, we'll miss you, and we really wish you the best of luck. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisfirm,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasia Pila,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hoke.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
This is Ground Control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
You know, it was just like a five-headed monster when we got together. It just gelled.
The B-52s were one of the most fun bands of the 1980s. And guess what? Kate Pearson is still really fun.
Oh, yeah. No, we said, you know, as long as this is fun, we'll still do it, and we're still doing it.
Kate Pearson, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.